You got the microphone, I see. Can I clip it on my shirt?
Well, it isn't, so it'll pick up. I just hate standing. If I can't, I don't like being behind the podium. Thank you. Yeah. I just like being close to folks. It does something. It makes me honest. When there's something between me and people, I don't know what it does. I like just kind of being close to folks. It's just, I like it. But, my name's Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me here. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about, for me, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. What it's like now. Sandy can tell you what I'm like now. That's a whole other story. That's my wife. I just love Bill Wilson's story because I just feel like it just describes me to a T. When I first read it, and I've not met an alcoholic it doesn't describe to a T. When we finally get honest and just look at the principles involved in it. Obviously I wasn't born then or anything like that, but I had those same thoughts of grandiosity from the very beginning that Bill Wilson had, and my life just was an exact carbon copy. My childhood wasn't, well, it was pretty much, I guess, I think both my parents were adult children of alcoholics. Now, that didn't make me an alcoholic, and I'm convinced there's nothing in my childhood, there was nothing behaviorally that happened to me that made me an alcoholic. And the reason I know that is I am as behaviorally straight today as I'll ever get, and I'm still an alcoholic. Meaning that left to my own devices, self-centered thinking takes over, and I just completely just destroy myself in life. So I've still got it. Whatever it is, I've got it. And it wasn't something I learned. It kind of came from the inside. Those are some things I know about my alcoholism. I believe about my alcoholism. So I'm not going to be fixed on the outside either. Growing up in that environment, I think my childhood, it didn't have anything to do with my alcoholism, but it kind of shaped what the challenges would be for me to recover. And I came from an environment where my dad was, we were blue collar folks. He was they were just normal, good people that really, for all the world, wanted to have a nice, successful life. And their life was absolutely ravaged by alcoholism. Neither of them ever took a drink. But yet their lives was ravaged by alcoholism. I'll tell you why. Both, this isn't my story, I'll just tell it briefly. Both my parents' parents were, they had alcoholic parents. And they didn't know it. So these guys, they met and they were two kind of crazy, kind of, what do you call it, Al-Anons. Not that they're all crazy. I want to have a peaceful ride home in the car. So I get a small car. I know now that's what played out in my life. I know now in retrospect, clearly my mom's parents were alcoholics. And I learned later that my dad's dad had died before I was born. But in listening to him describe his father, it became clear to me that probably he was alcoholic. My mom's parents were just violent alcoholics. It was just standard. It was an Italian dad and a German mother, and it was just wide open alcoholism. My mother was taken out of that house. Even at that point back then, you had to have a pretty rough environment to be taken out of your home. It just didn't happen in the old days when my parents grew up. And that happened to her. As a kid growing up, that just didn't seem strange to me. I remember we would go to Seattle, I'm from Tacoma, Washington, and we would go visit, and we'd visit her high school teacher with whom she lived for a while. And that just never struck me as, oh, wow, that's interesting. And she'd say, hi, Mrs. Smith, or whatever the lady's name was, and they would greet one another. And I'm just a little kid, 6, 7, 8 years old, and the whole thing just to me didn't seem odd. I know now it's odd. Again, it doesn't make me alcoholic, but it certainly, really what it's done for me is it's really helped me to accept the scope, the breadth, the width, and the depth of the problem that alcoholism is in our society. And I watched two people whose lives were just decimated by what happened to their children because of what happened to their parents, and they were really quite the innocent people in terms of what alcoholism did to them. So they raised us dysfunctionally, and the whole thing played out just as it should. Yeah, my father was just a competitive guy and really believed that it was just kind of a dog-eat-dog world. And you had to win. You had to come out on top. That's how life works. And that's just it. That's just, those are the rules. And that, of course, created in me, and Bill Wilson talks a lot about this, just a tremendous amount of fear because I knew that not everybody could win. So if I was going to win, what was going to happen to the rest of y'all? It didn't make any sense. My God in heaven, I was going to have to defeat the entire world based on this game plan that I was kind of learning growing up, and I was terrified. My mom was just that person, that Al-Anon person, very controlling, and had all those issues that went around that. And that's just how it played out. They didn't love each other. They couldn't love each other. They tolerated each other. And it was clear to me that it was one of the first lies I'd seen lived was them. They were married. And I knew that was the biggest lie I'd ever seen. I mean, I often walked around as a kid with really no sense whatsoever thinking, why on earth do they continue to put themselves through this? Later in life, after I got sober, I started to realize about those dysfunctional relationships and just kind of what happens and stuff in those. So I went to become the alcoholic. Now, weird things started happening to me from the get-go. I mean, I didn't look normal ever in my life. And I like to think I look relatively normal today, but I always like to say, too, that I have an office mate that sits from this part. We're this close. And we spend probably, in the last 5 years where I've worked, I've spent 4 hours a day, if not that close to somebody. And you can't help but get to know their life because you can't help overhear their phone calls. You just can't help. It's just where the office is no bigger than this little square like this. So the phone rings, and I've had two office mates, and I can tell you for a fact that non-alcoholics do not live, think, or feel anything like we do. I mean, that's not my wishful thinking. I've actually watched, like, my God, you're just going home, huh? Yeah, going home. You coming back tomorrow? Yeah. I mean, just weird stuff like that. I mean, you're not coming out of your skin, huh? No, not at all. Come back more days, going to weeks, going to months, going to years, and they look the same every single day, and they're not having to do anything like go to meetings and pray, and then they just don't do anything. Don't get off track. If I were to think, and this is just my own theory, you can do what you want with it, but I think if you just took the fear out of an alcoholic, you'd get kind of a normal person. Because when things go wrong in their lives, they don't go nuts. They don't even know they're wrong. I mean, they just naturally just go right through it, you know. There's a little tiff at work. They just naturally just go right through it. Nothing happens to them. Day in and day out, they never get fired. They do quite well. Anyway, they may think they want to, you know, I'm really mad, but then by the time they leave the office, they don't do anything weird. So anyway, I know I do think different, and that's why I need y'all. I need to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. It's lifelong for me. I'm clear. We met a guy last night at the end of a meeting, and I was talking to him. He was in the meeting. He'd been there about 60 days. And I said, do you think you're alcoholic? He said, I think so. I said, well, let me ask you, have you been able to quit drinking? He said, I've been able to quit drinking before. I said, how'd you feel? He said, I quit for a year once. How'd you feel? And he knew he should say, well, since I want to quit, life should be better, right? It would be stupid at 60 days sober to say, I quit drinking, life got worse. But you could see him stop. Yeah, and I knew I was talking to another alcoholic. I said, well, you're in the right place. You're one of us. And I felt really at home with him. That's the acid test for me. If simply stopping drinking was a solution, I wouldn't be what I call alcoholic. And I'd be fine. I wouldn't be here. Just so you know, I ain't gonna tell a story. I'll briefly tell something. I knew a guy, and I worked with him, who was a blackout drinker, had actual blackouts, and people say that that's alcoholism. His name's Andy, and he's a nurse. He's happy as can be. He hasn't had a drink in 15 years. And I used to say, Andy, you know, we're close enough. Do you think he knows about me? Do you think you're alcoholic? And he said, I don't know, Mark. He said, he'd tell me just wild drinking stories, blackout drinking. And I said, well, how'd you quit? And he said, well, I was in the military and I was getting out and I knew I couldn't drink like that anymore. It was bothering my wife. And I just quit. And I said, and have you been all right since then? I mean, how's your family? You still married? You got kids? How long have you had this job? So I've been here, you know, going on 18 years and still married to the same woman. My children are fine. Well, I took it and do what you want. I mean, I took what I did with it. I said, my God in heaven, he is not alcoholic that you can drink like that. Why anybody would do it, I don't know. But he did. Well, anyway, so growing up, I was never, ever, ever normal. And just life was just this terrifying thing to me. Bizarre things happened to me from the get-go. My life was absolutely unmanageable from the onset. Outwardly, I could keep it in the tracks, but inwardly, strange things happened to me. And I remember around the second grade, one of the strange things happened. I remember standing there around a fight. There were some kids in a fight, and that was kind of intriguing to me. God forbid I never ever wanted to be in one, because there had to be a loser, and there was a 50% chance that might be me, and I couldn't deal with that. I just was a guy that couldn't deal with. I was afraid to lose. I was afraid to engage life. It's hard to engage life when you're afraid to lose. There aren't many things that you left to do except drink. I remember getting close to it, though, when they were kind of fighting. I was making my hands into fists, and I was standing there, and I was just kind of getting some vicarious pleasure out of it. And the next thing I know, I'm in it and getting beat up. And I wasn't, and I'm not sure even today how that happened. But I suspect that in the second grade there was some manageability in me that I said something or did something that would somehow end their conflict and begin one that involved me. And that sort of thing happened to me most of my life. I just don't know how it was. I mean, you know, I would be all right with folks, and the next thing I know, I'm in conflict with folks, and I'm afraid, and life is just unmanageable. And it was like that for a long time. One of the first really weird things that happened to me was, well, I wanted to play sports, because that's a great competitive outlet. I don't want to play. That's not right. My father told me I ought to play sports, and I didn't want to do anything. I wanted to stay home and just stay inside the house, because I was afraid of everything. And so he said, well, you know, we're going to involve you in some sports. And he picked a couple weird sports. I mean, the first one you can't mistake as an insult. It was karate. Now, everybody knows, I mean, you know, as old as I am, 47, that many years ago, karate just wasn't common. There was no UFC fighting. Only kids who were in there were the ones getting bullied at school. So he sent me off to the karate class, and I knew what that meant. And so I went through the thing and hated every minute of it. I just not enjoy that at all. I didn't enjoy it then. But I would do it. I hated it. And but the one sport that I, in a sense, I was going to play some sports was wrestling. And I decided to be a wrestler. And that was kind of a big part of my life. You were a wrestler. Billy, I swear to God, when you said that the other day from the podium, I looked at him like, Billy, that just doesn't sound like your sport. I mean, you know, wrestlers are big bulked up, you know, it ain't mine either. And it didn't turn out to be either. But you could do it alone. You didn't have to be on a team, since I had the inability to make teams and be, you know, connect with people. And my thought was, if you just worked hard enough, this is right back to Bill Wilson's story, if you just worked hard enough, you're going to win. Now, surely I can outwork people. That's the thing I have control over, is I can work harder to get what I want. You know, and so I did. I commenced to wrestle, like Bill Wilson in his golf, I suspect, where he says, I commenced to overtake Walter Hagen, but alcohol overtook me. Well, I commenced to wrestle. I was going to make a name for myself. I was going to be someone at last. You know, I had arrived, and I had read all the books, and I had a coach, my own coach, and I practiced at home, and all was good for a while. I was winning some matches. But this terrible thing happened to me. Every time I'd get a decent record, like up to like 7-1 or 7-0, I remember the numbers, it was like it was yesterday, all of a sudden I couldn't wrestle anymore and I'd get beat. I mean, and it was this self-consciousness, just, I was consumed by fear. I could never get over the top, and that sort of thing followed me forever. It followed me into my life. I would have every reason I should win, whatever the event was, and I would still lose at the very last time. It's like, all you got to do now, it reminds me of a movie where this guy said, if you can write your name, I'll give you $1 million. And the guy said, oh, I can write my name. And he writes and he screws it up. You know, yeah, well, I don't know if you ever saw that. It was that show with Walter, the two guys, the Odd Couple. And one of them challenged the other one. He said, if you can do that. And he screwed up, the old guy, the messy one, screwed up his name. And I thought, I can identify with that. I would get so close. You know, all you got to do is hold on. You got 2 points in the match. All you got to do is hold on. Don't even, and I'm not, I'm just being defensive. And I learned now in life that you just can't do that. And I get pinned. And that just happened again and again, and I just couldn't figure it out. That sort of thing followed me into life because, you know, that self-consciousness. I wasn't having fun anymore. In the beginning, wrestling was kind of fun. I didn't have to win. I wasn't expected to win. I was just a goofy kid. But when you were 7-0, you had to win. And the fun was gone out of it. That sort of thing followed me my entire life. I spent a lot of my recovery reinventing fun in my life. And the book talks about that at length. And if you haven't allowed yourself the latitude to do it, please do. It's critical. It's the essence. It's one of the benefits of recovery. God knows. You know, we put this thing first, and I'll go on my story. And say, on the way up here, I got a phone call from a guy that you know. I ain't going to say his name. We did a group inventory yesterday, and he didn't show up. And he called me up today, and he said, Mark, he said, I got the bike. He bought a Husqvarna 310, two-stroke, on-off-road, dirt bike type thing. And you know, it was bittersweet. And I knew he couldn't really afford it. I mean, the guy's in kind of dire straits. And as I said, well, I said something that when I kind of do goofy things that my sponsors say to me, and I know now when he says it, what it means, he'd say, "Way to go." And I never knew what it meant until about an hour ago when I told this guy, "Way to go, you got the bike, why weren't you at the inventory?" And his life's a mess. I mean, he's in retreat. He's at the same problem. He's a guy that got himself, tell a little bit of his story, got himself from inmate to medical school, but started flunking tests when he had a 3.8 GPA from the University of San Francisco. He was at VCU in medical school and couldn't pass a test. You know what's happening. You're not supposed to flunk out of medical school. It's just, those tests are just, they're just there to mark your progress. Nobody flunks out. But he did. He flunked a year. It may have been he should have gone to the group inventory. I'm going to tell one more little bit of his story. Right before he was flunking, rock bottom. This is true. And he flunked two little sections. If he flunked the third one, he's out for the year. And we met. He was utterly depressed. Had 12 years sobriety when we met. And I said, well, let me tell you, tomorrow night at the prison is clearance night. That means you can go and get yourself cleared to go into the prison. He said, "Mark, Friday is my test for the third thing. If I flunk this one, I'm out." I said, "Well, I tell you, if you don't go to the prison, you'll be taking the test alone. If you go, God will be with you." And from where I'm standing, I think you probably better venture to the ladder. Well, he did. He went and he went to the prison. He went through the orientation. He came to the group in the orientation before the meeting, stayed the meeting, and didn't run out of the meeting at 9 o'clock like he was utterly terrified of life. And he scored a B on that test the next day. You know, that's just the hardest objective evidence I've ever seen that if you do this thing, those things come to pass. And that self-consciousness was off. And you know, could you imagine having an alcoholic mind taking a test? I had one. I mean, this is my own story. You could study all the time to get ready for taking this test. Man, you are the smartest. It's like wrestling. I'll make that long story short. I was a terrible wrestler. But I was in academics, and I had studied every book known to man. I was up dawn till dusk. I'd stop sleeping days before the test and just study straight through. There was nothing I didn't know. And the test would come, and I would sit there going, "Wait a minute, are they saying it like this, or are they saying it like this?" Totally consumed with that self-centered, self-conscious crap that if it wasn't in me, I'd go, "Of course they're asking that." Well, yes, but no, not me. I'm a doctor, and the MCAT, which is the admissions test before medical school, I tell you, I got to be one before a second. But I wasn't a regular doctor, I'll tell you that. I was an alcoholic doctor. So again, I had studied. I was all ready for that test. I had stayed up 3 days straight, usual stuff. And there wasn't a stone left unturned. My father had spent good money on the Kaplan course, which is a review course. And I mean, I'm the guy that should just kill it, right? I mean, you got it in the bag now. Come on, this is all old stuff. You've been studying for years. You're an undergrad, and you're just going to sit down now and take some easy test questions. And the night before that test came, it's good. I just wrapped up physics. I'm all done. All right, man. It's 9 o'clock. I'm hitting the sack. And I climbed in bed and pulled my little fluffy pillow up my head. And you probably know what happened. I laid there. And I laid there. And 10 o'clock came. I was like, "Oh, shit. Man, I got to get to 6, but still I got 8 good hours." I laid there at 11, 12, 1. I go get my roommate. I'm like, "Mark, I don't know I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what's going on." I'm like, "Dude, I can't sleep. If I don't sleep tomorrow, my career, everything I've studied for is down the drain." And he's like, "Well, let me rub your back." Now I'm a straight guy, but even like my roommate, so he gives his back rub. I'm like, "All right, that's gonna work, man." 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. I swear I didn't sleep 3 minutes that entire night. And the next morning, I got up. I looked like crap. I felt like crap, and I performed almost like crap. I mean, it was the worst day of my life. But that was the sort of thing. This is Bill Wilson's story. I had that boomerang. I had carved with that. I could do it. Me alone, me against the world, had swung around and continued to come back and destroy me on every front. And that was just the story of my life. That wrestling thing, I ended up just losing my mind in that. I'd go in the gym, And we'd weigh in. Back then, you could actually be in your underwear around other men. I mean, it's the weirdest thing in school now. I don't know if y'all have kids in school, but like my kid comes home and we're going swimming in the pool at our house, and he's like, I'm like, I just put on a swimsuit. He's like, Dad, aren't you going to swim with your underwear on? I'm like, no, Reed, why would I do that? And he goes, well, I always do. And when we change, he wants to be separate. I'm like, dude, we're men here. And he says, well, at school we don't change like that anymore. But I'm like, all right, well, whatever. The times are changing. But when I was a young wrestler, we were in the locker room, and we would see the other guys wearing our underwear. They were in their skibbies, and we'd all go up and do a little scale thing. One guy'd get on the scale, you'd get on the scale. I'd always look at the guy under the guy that wrestled. I'm like, that guy looks kind of tough. But that guy, a weight class under him, I'd kick his butt, man. I'd throw him all over the mat. Just like I do the guy on our team who's a weight class under me. But we're alcoholic. I always like to say, I've never seen a group of people smarter than alcoholics. And I've never seen a group of people less to show for it than alcoholics. And so, I looked at that kid under him, and I'm like, and I saw, we go in order, and that little kid got up there, and what class ahead of me, our guy got up. I'm like, man, if I were only wrestling him. And I figured out what a calorie was. And I started eating canned string beans, and I just ate them all the time, and I lost weight, and I got down to his weight, and I was going to kick his butt. But lo and behold, when I got there, he was my weight now, and he was the same size. That was the alcoholic mind misses. That's characteristic of alcoholic thinking. That's my logic. If anybody works with alcoholics, it's hard to see in yourself. If you work with an alcoholic, you sponsor somebody, you hear that kind of logic all the time. So I looked, I'm like, I don't know how this happened, but these dudes seemed so small when they were a weight class down. But the guy under him seemed small yet. So I ate some more beans and I got down another weight class. And I got so skinny that they didn't want me even to wrestle anymore. I couldn't hardly, I mean, there was just no muscle, no meat. Sure, there was not an ounce of fat. The coach was like, dude, you got to quit. I'm losing every match I get in, but my head is so spun up and twisted. I can't give up. I can't give up. I've got to hang it to the end. I can beat this thing. I just need to run more, work harder. To remind you, this is how I dealt with my own alcoholism. Life in general, yeah, I just approached it that way. So the season ended, and my eating, I could not eat normally after that. I had done something bizarre, and all of a sudden I just had lost, that's the first time I lost the control of eating, and it was really weird. I couldn't eat, and I went into this spell of anorexia. I was like the first male anorexic in Washington State. But, and at that point, you wouldn't get sent to a psychologist or anything. They just looked at me and everybody, no one said anything outwardly to me. But people just, you know, you had to know they were thinking, what is wrong with him? I mean, I looked terrible. I mean, really, 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 really bad. So bad that they wouldn't let me play sports. That's how weird my childhood had gotten. That was the eighth grade. And that sort of thing, that sort of obsessive, compulsive, bizarre, intense, kind of goofy thinking just destroyed my life. That desire to win, coupled with, you know, this insanity. Inability to make friends with people. Now I've kind of become a lone wolf. And like Bill likes to say, I mean, in my own head, sure, I had some outward friends at times. But I was alone for the most part. It wasn't like I'm in this room. I mean, I feel in this room connected with everybody sitting here. But I never felt that then. I didn't feel any connection. It was that, you know, that the stage actor had emerged. There was a guy that was putting out there. And then there was a real me. And that gap was starting to widen. I was becoming more alone and afraid and in my own head. And not really knowing anything what to do. I was just totally lost. So that's kind of where I was. And then the solution came. Thank God for the solution. It came, and it came in the form of beer, whatever it was. I can't even remember what my first drink was. But in a very short period of time, all those problems in my life were swept away. Life was good. Life was good. If I were going through the promises right now, all those promises were being met. You know, at that point in my life, I didn't feel alone. I didn't regret the past. I wished to shut the door on it. I felt useful. You know, I fit in with everybody. The promises had come true, and I'd found the solution for the way I felt. And I drank like an alcoholic from the get-go, right out of the box. Bizarre things happened to me around my drinking, because I drank the same way I did most other things. Crazy things, like I'd lose my car. I couldn't help from throwing up on myself. Some of my biggest goals were to go to a party and not throw up. That was really it, if I could just not do that. That was really killing me with the women. I mean, that was just, you know, it's all good until you go, or drop your drink. Those are the two biggest problems that I had for the rest of my drinking career. Losing my car was never a problem, but I did it quite regularly. I would drink till I was amnestic, and I'd walk out of the house, and I had no earthly idea where I parked. I'd go to the party, and I have no idea where my car was. And I'd have to call people the next morning and find out, and, you know, just stuff like that. And that's just how I drank, and I'd tell lies to my parents of what was happening. And I could tell some good lies, I'll tell you that, man. I remember one, you know, my parents, they didn't know what to do with me. Wow, this is silly stuff. But I told a lot of lies and got away with a lot of lies. But I don't really believe that they really believed all that stuff. I know they didn't. I know that that marijuana pipe that my dad found in the trash can of my car when I said it was Russ Bevel's, you know, he probably thought, why would Russ's dope pipe be in your car? You know, I mean, I know that he was kind of, you know, I think they were kind of onto me. Or I loved mischief, and there was no opportunity I didn't get in some mischief. If you had a mischievous plan, I was with you. And man, it was just fun. Life was good. I was a drinking drunk kid, and we liked to throw eggs at anything we could and steal eggs. And I worked at a restaurant, and so naturally they only paid me $2.25 an hour. So I made up for that by just stealing things. And one of the things I loved to steal were the eggs. If they bought their eggs, they would get 12 by 12, so it was like 144 eggs, and I'd call my friends, now meet me behind the restaurant at exactly such and such hour, and I'd come around the corner carrying the big thing eggs and throw it in the car, and we'd spend the entire night throwing eggs and just had more fun. I also liked to stand out, go behind the restaurant, lob eggs over the car over the restaurant on the Pacific Avenue and hit the cars, and then run back inside, and people would stop and come in the restaurant and they say, somebody just threw an egg in my car. And the managers these are older ladies, would look around and go, sir, they'd look around back washing the dishes. No, and that happened so many times. You just had to kind of blow it out a little bit at work, you know what I mean? But this is in the middle of my alcoholism when I'm drinking, and life's good. I'm drinking every night and just doing whatever I put my hands on. Life is just good at that point. That was a fun place. There was also another little fringe benefit of being in the restaurant, and we had whipped cream in that restaurant. And if you hold the whipped cream can right side up and inhale the propellant, you actually can inhale nitrous oxide. And that'll make your work day go by a little faster, too. So if you're slaving away on the dishes and you're like, man, I don't know if I can take any more of this. It's 20 after, and you're slaving away. You can just slip on back to the walk-in and grab one of those big industrial whipped cream cans. Don't try this. And that worked great for a while, but there's a problem is when the propellant is out of the can, when they turn it up onto the pie or cake where they're serving, whipped cream doesn't come out, just cream comes out. And so they wrote the Dairy Gold or called them up people, and they said, you all sent us defective whipped cream cans. This is really a problem. And Dairy Gold rightly responded with, no, somebody in your organization is inhaling the propellant out of those cans. But they'd seen this problem before, oddly enough. It's probably one of y'all. And it was no doubt one of us. No doubt about that. You can do it in grocery stores, too. So one day they lined us up. This isn't what got me canned. But they lined us up, and they said, and this huge overweight boss, this very just big threatening lady, she owned the restaurant, and she said, she was walking along, and she said, one of you is inhaling the whipped cream, the inhalant out of the whipped cream cans. And we know this because, you know, she goes through this whole story. And I'm there, just looking really smug and kind of fitting in and thinking it's all good. And you know, she said, man, we're going to find out who. I thought, there's no way they're going to figure this out. I mean, after all, it was me and four other elderly Japanese women that ran the place. They didn't even speak English. They used to call me Marky-san. Marky-san. You know, they're nice, you know, just salt-earth people, you know. Just that's the kind of mind I had. I felt absolutely, the way it ended was one day I was back there inhaling some nitrous oxide, and I got called right when I was doing it, and I wasn't thinking straight. So rather than just put the can on a shelf, and walk back and say, yes, how can I help you? I put in the towel I had in my hand, which is the one I was using for the dishes, and ran in there, and I stopped and I said, yes, and right then I dropped the can and it rolled right to her feet. So I had to find a new job shortly thereafter. Now, I quit the next day, but the day after that, I was going to be fired, I'm sure. But that was the kind of insanity that just punctuated my life. And yeah, it was all good. I had a good time drinking, and life was good. It was a solution to my problems. But the doggone thing happened is the solution started, it turned on me. And I'm not really sure. It started turning on me one little bit at a time. And I started doing things that even I regretted. I mean, fun is fun. But then there were times that I actually started becoming dangerous, and I was becoming dangerously antisocial and doing things that I just never dreamt I would ever do, and I understand clearly in that book. You know where it describes the four types of alcoholics, the guy that's always going to quit, you know, and there's two or three other types. I mean, I'm just, each one of those is in me. Well, one day I was out, and I had just a spoiled kid I was. I had gotten, when I was little, I got bit by a dog. And I got, and I was like 6 years old, and I got the scar, and we ended up suing the people, and we got $9,000. That was a lot of money back then. And I'm not sure if we needed to sue them or not. I was just a little kid. And so I went in the bank when I was 18, I could take it out. And being a young, budding professional that I was going to be, I could spend it on college, I spent it on a Corvette. And this is a natural thing to do. And so one night after community college, I had graduated oddly enough from community college, and I was driving on the highway. There was a divider between me and the exit on, you know, you get on and off the highway, and there's a police car over there. And I had messed around with police cars my entire life in Tacoma, Washington. I really had very little respect for them. And he was over there, and we were over there, so I just showed him my bottle and tipped it up and I gave him the finger or whatever, and we just roared off down the highway. And because he couldn't get back on, you know, if the guardrail would make it where he couldn't get back on. But I'm telling you, those police cars are amazing in what they can do. It wasn't long after that he was right behind us. And not only that, he called his friends. I mean, they were having a party. I mean, I looked back there, and it was like on TV. There was a string of police back there. So we got that thing up to about 135 and just roared down I-5 as fast as we could. And then they were persistent. They stayed right on us. And throwing whiskey bottles and some others, you know, I think we had some marijuana or just God knows what, you know, out of the car windows. And finally we got off and made a few quick turns. And there was a very busy intersection on Bridgeport, 100th Street and Bridgeport. I was on Bridgeport, and it was 100th Street that crosses. I was on Lakewood. And the reason I kind of remember this is I knew better. Never, ever go blazing through an intersection where the light is red, you know, when you go right through that red light. Well, you can't see what's coming. I mean, and I did it that day. And on the other side of that intersection, I'll say this, I emerged from that intersection I went into that intersection a boy, and I emerged from that intersection, I'm not going to say a man, but somebody that even scared me. On the other side of that, I did this smile. Remember, like it was yesterday. There was a defining moment in my alcoholism. We ended up getting away, and by just making a bunch of turns and jumped out of the car and jumped in bed and pretend we were asleep, and it was just a whole silly thing. And they came to the house. It took them like 1 minute to find the car and asked us to come out. And we told them we'd been there for hours, and you know the car is sitting there, steam coming out of the radiator, and that kind of a thing. And we did get away. But I was different, and that's where my alcoholism really started to kind of. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I didn't know what was going on with me. From that point on, you know, I really started to keep my life a secret because I knew now nobody would want to hear about kind of the guy I was, and I started doing things worse and worse and worse in every way of my life, and that's alcoholism. If you've ever been through this, you'll know what I'm talking about. Lines at that point, you know, I was always going to outgrow my childhood. I was always going to outgrow it. It's just, you know, I'm just a kid. But after that, things kind of changed for me, and it just seemed like, or maybe I became cognizant, that now I was kind of the kind of guy that if you were a girl, you'd been better off not meeting me. And if you were a guy, you were probably going to be better off not meeting me. And it's not, I mean, I just did bad things. I just did things it's not the kind of stuff you aspire to do. Just, you know, I couldn't control any part of my life. None. My own sexuality was completely out of control and things happened because of that. You know, if you're not, you know, there are contraceptives. I didn't understand that. And I was too selfish to even use them. And I look back, and it just, my life was a mess, an absolute mess. And that was alcoholism. And I didn't do those things drunk. I didn't do any of this. I mean, I've run from the cops drunk. But the way I was not because I was drunk. It was because I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't understand any of this. I didn't understand what had happened to me, why I was the person I was. But still, outwardly, I looked good. And I went, I made it through those phases of my life, and I made it as through as an undergrad, and I did the time. I knew I could not drink and go to school because I couldn't think. And so I stopped, and I could do the time. And I graduated, got into medical school. Now, mind you, I mean, there were some real red, you know, there were some signs that I was completely out of my mind. Like, I told them in an interview once that I wanted to go to Africa and save people in Africa. And they said, well, have you ever been to Africa? No. I mean, that medical school, that was the University of Washington, that was the one I was a citizen, that was my in-state, I was in-state there. They put me, I was an applicant so far as my grades, I was in the upper like 10% of the applicant pool, even higher. They put me on a list that was, there was a three list, four lists, the bottom list, they're not even going to take it. The second of the bottom list is, if everybody they accepted dies, they'll consider you. I ended up on that list, and I never understood why. I would go to an interview and they'd ask me, why do you want to be a doctor? I didn't say, because they make a lot of money. My dad told me I should. Isn't that enough? And those were the only reasons. The only reasons, bar none. You know that self-centerism we get, that it's delusional. We don't even know we have it. I remember people telling me, I had this girlfriend that used to tell me, she said, you are self-centered. I didn't even know what the words meant. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Anyway, get in the car. We're going to go do something. What we have, it's just so deep inside. It's not like I'm intentionally being like this. I am like this. Totally different than being like this. It is who I was. And by the grace of God and the power of this program, the 12 Steps, I've been able to take a look at some of that stuff and redirect my self-centeredism into a way that helps others, and then in that turn, get help myself. Anyway, I went through medical school. I didn't go in particularly bad, but I had the same kind of goofy stuff going on. I mean, I was not, you know, I was just not a good guy. I mean, I can't think of anything really to add to that. Graduated, and I picked a residency. Now, as a alcoholic, I decided anesthesiology would be a good career for me. It just seemed like the logical thing to do. After all, I mean, my mind was just kind of seemed geared for this sort of work. And exactly, it's well, it didn't take long. So I would notice that the anesthetics would have the same effect on the patients as alcohol had on me. Now, being with a keen alcoholic mind, you know what the next step is. So, but I don't know. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know anything. And so I graduate. And midway, as I'm coming to graduation, I start experimenting with these things. And they do exactly, I can tell you that anesthesia will decrease your craving for alcohol. If you're anesthetized, you will not need to drink. It's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And so I did that a little bit, and it worked well, because drinking wasn't conducive in the hospital. Like, when I drank, I like to drink wild and do stupid stuff, and that just didn't fly well in the hospital. But if you took narcotics, it didn't have that effect on me. It was very sedating, and, I had some problems walking sometimes at work, and, my pupils were always very pinpoint. People would ask me things, and they would discover strange things in my briefcase at the end of the day, and I'd tell them, I'm just taking them home. I'll bring them back in the morning. God knows what I'd tell them. And there were people that knew what I was doing in that hospital, but they didn't do anything. Everybody gets a little sick around this disease. So, I'd left the residency. I graduated, oddly enough. And, you talk about it, just a complete just guy that just, one day, I couldn't have cared anything about a patient. I understood the rules. They said, if you do this, you'll get a paycheck. Thank you. And that was how I was going to handle my medicine. That was it. I mean, Bob Smith described it to a T. In his story, he said, it wasn't that I didn't want to help people. And if somebody would fall down right in front of me, I'd pick them up. But I wasn't going to go out of my way. And that's kind of, I think that describes me. Sure, I would do my job. Here's what you're supposed to do, okay. But so far as any real concern or responsibility beyond that, dude, when it was, when it was time to go, it was time to go, for the most part. So I went to this tiny town in Dunn, North Carolina. Well, it was Dunn, North Carolina. If you've ever been there, it's a very small town. And you cannot drink like I was accustomed to there. And I had to find something to keep this alcoholism off of me. Now, mind you, I didn't know any of this at the time. I just knew I had to find a relief for the way I felt. And I had ample access to all those anesthetics, and so I would just take them home. At the end of the day, whatever was left over, I'd just put it in my pocket and take it all home. No sense in wasting it. And that's how I'd get through the evenings. And that went on for a long time, and I can tell you, that was the first cure I found to alcoholism. I can guarantee you, if you inject enough anesthesia, you won't have to drink. I swear to God, it worked like a champ. But unfortunately, enough was getting into the range, the amounts that you'd actually do an entire operation with. And my way of coping with my alcoholism had become apparent to others. And so they had called the North Carolina Medical Board. They thought that I needed some help. And they came down and talked with me. And I wished I had gotten caught, because I really wanted this thing to end. I mean, it was horrible. It began in my wrestling career, and that insanity was still with me. I was absolutely insane. I could not find any relief, and now my only relief, people are having problems with. It just wasn't fair. Ended up, what happened was, I basically ended up just taking some things that I don't know if you've ever had, if anybody here has ever taken Thorazine. But don't. if you take that, you wished you hadn't. One day I did, and I had what I felt like an out of body experience, and I felt like my body was walking around at work. I couldn't tell who had been operated on, who hadn't been operated on, and I was at work, and I remember thinking, "Don't you know you're just talking to my body? I'm up here." I really felt like I was on top of myself, looking down at my body, and at that point, the fear of the pain of where I was at was greater than the fear of what was to come. It was greater than the fear of doing something. And the only thing I was ready to do something. I hit bottom. The only thing I knew to do was to call the medical board. And I wanted to go in anonymous. And so I called them up, and they'd already been to talk to me. And I said, "I'm an anonymous physician in Dunn, North Carolina. And I'd like to enter your program. I need some help." And on the other end, the guy goes, "Mark, is that you?" I mean, I was not. That has turned out to be the greatest gift of my life. I'm not a guy that needed to be anonymous. I'm really a guy that needs to wear who he is on his outside. And it never seemed like a gift, but God, it has helped me so many times in life. If given the, I can't run and shuck and jive on something. Now, when you've got that in your career, you've got to put that on every application, everywhere you go. It seems like when I would get an application, anything to do with medicine, if it were a 15-page application, the first 14 pages had to do with, "Have you ever had a felony? Have you ever been in treatment? Have you ever used heroin?" And at the end, it asked me, "What's your name?" You know, it just seems like that. Well, I got sober. I went to treatment, went off to treatment, and it was treatment was just plain wild, man. It did. It was a regular old treatment center, and I got out of that treatment center, and I understood I was an alcoholic. I understood that it wasn't going to go away. I understood it was an illness. I understood that, that's about what I understood right there. So far as being AA is a lifelong solution, I didn't buy that. I was, after all, still smarter than them, I mean, for God's sakes. It was my mindset. And I went home, and by noon the next day, I was coming out of my skin. And they had told me, "Go to AA." And you know, I just think it's the greatest God doing for me that I couldn't do for myself. I went to AA. And I called up a guy named Bubba, and he came over and picked me up in a pickup truck, and off we went. We went to AA. And I started to go to AA and done. I started to get sober. And the medical board wanted to know everything I was doing. And I think this saved my life. They said, "We want to see a list of your meetings that you're attending." And at that point, they had everything in my life that was important to me. They controlled my entire life. But that I would not give them AA. I knew not to give them AA. God has done so many things for me in my sobriety. They're just miraculous. And I took and I falsified that entire list of meetings, knowing if they ever found that out, I'd be in real deep trouble. But you know what? I went to AA for me. I didn't go for them. They wanted me to go to this thing called Caduceus, which is Dr. A. I went to that thing one time. I'll never go back. I came out there, I needed to go to an AA meeting. I was more afraid when I left that thing than when I went in. God, you talk about the problem. That was full of the problem. Anyway, And I would not give them that AA thing. AA was mine. And it's been that way ever since. I stayed in AA for a year and a half. Everything was good. But I never ever really did the program as I understand it now. I had a sponsor and we did some steps, but I didn't see my sponsor as a mentor in life. I did not see him as a guy that had, was ahead of me. He was solving the problems in life and he was going to pass that on to me. I just saw him as a guy to work the steps. Well, we're going to work the steps, right? And that's important. But a sponsor is so much more than that. When I think of my own sponsor, I think of the guy I'm going to call in this world when my back is to the wall. That's the one person I'm going to call. I'm not calling my parents. I love my wife dearly. She just said, get on, fool. That's him. That's my sponsor. That's my ace in the hole. That's it. That's it. Now, we do way more than that. Now, he's, you know, but that's how important he is in my life. I didn't understand any of this stuff. And so I left AA. At a year and a half sober, I left AA. And I just was done with it. I had gone to all the meetings, gone to the dances, gone to many meetings, in fact. And I just floundered around. I just cut up. I was just there. But nothing had really happened in my life in terms of the steps. I hadn't begun to amend myself to the career that I robbed everything I could from, to the institutions that I'd utterly just decimated my own life, like marriage, to society as a whole, which I couldn't care less about up until that point. I had done nothing that looked like a nine step beyond. I hadn't even paid back monetary debts. I was just the same old guy. And in terms of service work, I was doing nothing. My connection to a home group was non-existent. I had one I called my home group, but I sometimes went, sometimes didn't. And that's the AA for me. Well, I ran into this guy in Southern Pines, North Carolina. I left AA. And I went on a date, an alcoholic date. That's where you go on a date and then move in. And I went on a date, and I'd moved into her house. I was sleeping on her couch. And I knew something was wrong. And I knew that there was someone I met down there at the International. In 1995, I went to the International with my sponsor. That was before I had my opinion back. And I knew this guy lived around there, and I called him up and I said, dude or sir, would you be willing to meet with me? Would you and your wife eat dinner with me or breakfast with me and my girlfriend? I want to talk to you. And he said, surely we will. And he's a guy that is very, very, very busy in AA, but I'm convinced that Saturday morning, if he'd say, why don't you just come to our group Tuesday? I'm convinced I wouldn't be here. I really believe that. God works, and I've learned that. I've never in my own life. I always think when you're working with a new person, you wonder, can I just pull back a little bit? You just wonder, which brick would it have been in my own recovery if somebody had pulled back one brick? When would it have not been enough, and I would have died? So I just don't think we ever have the latitude to pull back, ever, because we just don't know that might be the time. We'll never know. That's between God and them. So I met with a guy, and we ate. And I described AA to me, as I just described it to you, and he said, that's an interesting program, it's not AA. And his name, this guy, is, you probably all know him, Tom I. And I said, all right, well, and I said, well, and he said, why don't you come to me on Tuesday, we'll talk. And I said, great. So I come there, and I said, I need a sponsor. Will you sponsor me? He said, no. I said, well, then who will? And he said, well, you could ask Wallace Bryant. Some of y'all know him. A guy, Waylon Collins, or a guy, and I'm blowing all their hand names, I probably shouldn't, and another guy, Doug Smith, who's dead, so I can say that. And I said, surely. I went and asked all three of them, and they all turned me down. And they were all guys he sponsored. And I came back, and I said, sir, I've asked all these people, and they aren't going to sponsor me. And he said something in effect, all right, I'll sponsor you, but I don't want any funny business out of you. He didn't say that. If y'all know him, he's a very loving guy. But in so many words, he said, I'm going to sponsor you, but don't waste my time. For God's sakes, man, if you're interested in what we're doing here, I'll help you to do this, and you can have a life that looks like mine. Well, I've got 1 minute to make a long story short, so I will. From that point on, I learned what a home group was, and I learned the power of a group. I learned what groups can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, that they're a group of people who band together to carry the message to the still-suffering alcoholic, and they have the resources and the ability to do that. And I learned that from him, because that's what our group did. I learned what making an amends meant. It wasn't, I'm sorry. Like, when I look back at the way I handled myself in so many areas of life that I described, an amends as being someone entirely different in those areas of life. The North Carolina Medical Board said, you'll never practice anesthesia again. It's too dangerous for you. And page 100 of the big book says that we can go anywhere we need to go, provided we are spiritually fit, that it's not a matter of proximity to anything. And they wouldn't let me practice. And for 5 years, they wouldn't let me practice. But because laws, you know, make it to where they got to turn me loose, they had to turn me loose. And they did. And not long after I was turned loose, somebody said, "Hey, why don't you come back and practice anesthesia with us?" And I said, "Man, you don't know my past." And they said, "Well, I think you'd be all right. Come on back." And I was afraid. I'd actually started to buy into some of that institutional thinking. I was really afraid. I actually started to believe maybe I can't. And it was totally wrong that I went back, and I do the same things I do today in every area of life in terms of service, corrections, PI, CBC, and treatment stuff. And that's just AA life. And it's worked profoundly well for me. I went back to that job. I worked there for a year, and I found that I was meant to do what I was in fact doing. And at the end of that, when I went there, I used to beg them, "Hire me, hire me." And they'd say, "No, no." And at the end of that, I quit doing that. I decided to just do an honest day's work. At the end of that, I said, "You know, I want to go do a fellowship, and I want to go into academic medicine. I want to teach medicine. I want to learn. I want to actually be what maybe I had in me to be." And they said, "You're nuts. You want to go back and train for another year? You can make no money." They said, "We'll hire you." I was ecstatic until I got home and thought for a second, "I can't do that." I knew that wasn't God's will for me. So I sent applications out all over the country. And I'm convinced nobody was looking for a guy with my past, because everybody turned me down. I mean, I'd go to interviews and everybody was excited about me until they learned about my past. And it was like I just grew another head right in the middle of the interview. Well, there's a large academic institution not far from here that had a training guy they were getting ready to train. And he was going to do it, but he got a divorce right at the last minute, like 2 weeks before the fellowship started. And there was nobody left in the applicant field for that year. Everybody had taken positions. And there was my application. And I kind of envisioned him kind of looking over it going, "God knows. How bad do we want to have this fellow this year?" Well, it must have been pretty bad. So I went there. They said, "When can you be here?" And I said, "How far is Richmond from North Carolina where I was at?" And they said, "It's about 3.5 hours. I said, "I'll be there in 4 hours." I went there, and man, well, I could just tell you this. There wasn't a case that was done at that large academic institution that was done that I wasn't a part of. I was so excited to be back doing what I was meant to do, I wouldn't go home. In fact, I was concerned they'd think that I was back stealing things from the OR because I was always there. At the end of that fellowship, they hired me. I thought they called me and they said, "Mark," the chairman and the co-chairman said, "Why don't you come to our office? We want to talk to you." Oh no. So I came and sat down there meekly, and the chairman sat there and he said, we want to hire you. And I turned around to see who he was talking to. And they hired me. And I stayed on there, and after my first year there, I got an award for teaching, which is something that is highly coveted. And years after that, I got awards for teaching. I had an opportunity there. The university said that we like people who are interested in teaching people, and they said, "We'll educate people, make them into teachers. Would you like to get a master's in education?" And I said, "I surely would." And they put me through the program. I have absolutely loved anesthesia. Being back in it, my job means the world to me, and it's what I was designed to do. My sponsor used to tell me, "You get up where you fell down." And by the grace of God, I was able to finally amend myself to a career, to an entire thing that I'd stolen everything from. I've been married to Sandy now for, I think, 9 years. And I can report that she may disagree. I think I've been a great husband. I mean, that I've not once did anything to the institution of marriage that I wouldn't openly talk about in this room. I have nothing to hide when before I had everything to hide always. AA has brought me everything I could have ever imagined in life. It has brought me everything and more. My kid is 14 years old and he's absolutely healthy and his brain works. He's not insane. We've had foster kids. We've had great times. And we've been a part of a home group. Sandy's an Al-Anon and I'm an AA. We've been a part of a home group that's just not like your home group that is looking to carry the message. There's still suffering alcohol. We do it together. And we have a clear primary purpose, and we're joined in that desire to help others. And it's just been the greatest joy I've ever experienced, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's enabled me to be, do, feel, and experience things I never conceived that I used to stand and watch others do and go, "I wonder what it feels like to be honest, or to be courageous, or to stand up for yourself, or to accept blame and be all right with it." And because of AA, I've been able to live and experience and feel those things. Thanks for having me. Oh, yeah. Let me feel it back.